learned from COVID-19 is that something small can spread quickly, like a ripple. If enough of us do our part by getting vaccinated, we can start a wave. A wave of Canadians helping each other return to the people and places we love. We can all help by getting vaccinated. Learn more at canada.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
Can music give you what you need? Does sound have the power to process complex emotions? Can placebos help? How are you today?
I'm Erin.
And I'm Julia.
How are you
and
today?
We're here to offer a kind of help with Audio Placebo Plaza. For 1 week, we offer everyday people customized positive messages, audio creations, healing frequencies, binaural beads, ASMR, and more. From June 11th to 16th at 6835 Rue Saint-Hubert and on undefined.fm.
This project is produced by Undefined Radio and co-presented by Sony Pearl Popolo and CKUT.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM. Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised. Hi all, welcome back to the show. It's 6.02 p.m. and you're listening to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Jajage. This week, the Lorenza Botner exhibit at the Leonard and Binna Ellen Art Gallery at Concordia University will come to a close. I saw this exhibit last week, and I really want to encourage others to check this out. Lorenza Botner, Requiem for the Norm, is the first major monographic survey of Chilean-German artist Lorenza Botner's life work. A trans person without arms, Botner worked in painting, dance, performance, photography, and installation to generate a body of work that celebrated her standpoint and gender expression, resolutely transgressing and refusing any and all ableist and gender normative prescriptions. It's curated by Paul B. Preciado, author of Testo Junkie. And the gallery is open this Thursday through Saturday, and the exhibit itself closes on the 19th. For today's show, though we do not have a podcast that is dedicated to Lorenza's life and work, I wanted to play the Textual Feelings podcast episode that dives into Paul B. Preciado's book, Testo Junkie, Auto Theory, The Pill, and the Pharmacopornographic Era. Of course, as always, we only have the hour on the radio airwaves, so you can check out the rest of this Textual Feelings episode wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Thanks so much for tuning into Queer Core. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Rosie.
And I'm Matty. Rather blocked up Matty today, I have to say. And welcome to Textual Feelings, a podcast about genre-bending books, creative nonfiction, queer feminisms, and much more.
Textual feelings.
And actually, I should say welcome to the last ever episode, because after a year, Textual Feelings is coming to an end.
Yeah, and we are very, very sad about it. But we've got to do our thing, you know. Matty's moving to the USA to do a PhD, and we are going to just have to figure out how our collaboration will change its shape.
Yeah, like maybe some kind of transatlantic form that doesn't involve hours and hours spent together in person. But We really want to thank you all so much for listening. Those of you who've supported us right from the beginning, like even our parents, although I do hope my parents don't actually listen to this. But also those of you who've come to know us along the way, like we've really loved every moment of working together. It's been a huge learning experience, like intellectually and also technologically, because I at least had no idea how to use sound editing software before this. But yeah, we really hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble on.
Yes, as we shall continue to do for the next hour plus, because this is going to be quite a big episode. So today, we are going to be talking about Paul Preciado's spectacular book, Testo Junkie, Sex, Drugs and Biopolitics in the Pharmacopornographic Era.
It's kind of an intimidating title.
Yeah, it's a big title, but don't turn us off. Because it's really exciting. This book is many things. A memoir of self-experimentation, a history of the creation of gender in the 20th century, a theory book about sexuality and gender, a manifesto, a polemic, a novel. Mm-hmm. And it manages to be all of these things in a very extreme way, which sounds mysterious, but I think you'll come to understand what we mean by that.
Yeah, let's hope so.
So we were both very excited to work on this book, but neither of us had read it in a while and realised when we reread it how much of a mammoth task it would be. And then it was too late to change our mind. So, this episode is slightly longer than usual, but we're really, really excited about it.
Yeah.
So to introduce the author briefly, Paul Preciado, like Testo Junkie, is many things. A writer, a philosopher, an activist, and also a curator. And as well as teaching courses in universities such as NYU, he was one of the curators of the contemporary art exhibition Documenta, which takes place every 5 years and was in Castle in Athens last year.
Yeah, and you were there for the Athens opening.
I was indeed. It was very strange. But I did see Paul Preciado in bed with Annie Sprinkle.
Huh?
But that was, it was a performance, so it wasn't okay. Me spying on them. But yes, and Preciado is probably best known for his writing, and Testo Junkie was first published in 2008 in Spanish and French, then in English in 2013, translated from the French by Bruce Benderson. And it was published by the Feminist Press, a really great publishing house in New York.
Mm.
This book is Preciado's second, coming after the Manifesto Contrasexual, which was published in Spanish in 2002, and before Pornotopia, an essay on Playboy's architecture and biopolitics, published in 2014.
Right.
Preciado is a trans man who, since Testo Junkie's first publication, has changed his name from Beatrice to Paul.
Yeah, and our copies are both from the fourth edition. And this was important because this edition marks the first time that the book's published with the author's name as Paul B. Preciado, as opposed to Beatrice. And this change is actually addressed in a note at the beginning of the book, which states that while Paul's name has changed, and the initials of the narrator used in the book have been left the same as before, so BP. He sums this up his position on this by writing, "Understand that Paul absorbs and assumes all that was once BP." So we're going to be using male pronouns when talking about the narrator and the writer. These are Preciado's current correct pronouns. But I also think it's worth saying, and this will become clearer as we go, that Preciado's approach to writing about himself in the book as a lesbian, as a trans man, as a body hooked on tea, as he puts it, doesn't give us like the tools or the right to define Preciado's relationship to his own gender, which is obviously not something we can do as readers. Yeah. But also because, as you'll know if you've read the book, his approach to gender is so highly deconstructive that it just refuses any simple categorisation. So that's a practical but also political note about how we're going to be talking about the book and its narrator slash writer, but that's not to conflate those two subject positions. And in fact, as with the Argonauts and with many of the texts that we've talked about in the podcast and referred to in our library talk, if you listen to it, so that's books like I Love Dick, it's important to foreground the literary, performative and even fictional nature of this kind of writing. So it might draw on the memoiristic, the personal, but nonetheless it's not simply or maybe even actually memoir. So these writers are using their own names and elements of their own biographies, yes, but that doesn't mean that we get to conflate their narrators with the writers themselves. But we'll come back to that in more detail later as a kind of interesting topic. But, you know, for now, how to begin describing this book.
What a task.
So I think there's a lot of different layers involved in describing this book to those who don't know it, and even to those who do.
Yeah.
It's such a treat for us, actually, as readers, to be able to try and do this, because it will really help us understand how the book functions and what its form does. I mean, it's such a slippery, shifting book. Every time I read it, or even like every other sentence, I think it's a different book.
Yeah. Okay, well, to give a literal sense of the structure, we can say that there are 13 chapters and an introduction.
Yeah.
And it's a big old book, around 400 pages.
It's heavy.
Yeah. And 7 of the chapters are structured around BP's experiment of taking testosterone in the form of testogel outside the medical system.
Yeah, and by outside the medical system, we mean that BP isn't being prescribed testosterone as part of a medically defined gender transition, but is buying testosterone on the black market, so as actually part of a community of trans people who he calls gender hackers.
Yeah. And at this time, BP is living in Paris, and the account starts just after the death of Guillaume Doustan, referred to in the text as GD, a friend of Preciado's who died in 2005. Preciado then meets VD, who is Virginie Despentes, one of the directors of the French crime thriller Rape Revenge, Baise-moi, which is great if you haven't seen it. And they embark on an intense and exciting love affair. I'm making it sound like a bad romance novel, which it really isn't, but anyway. The rest of the 6 chapters act both as a text that charts the history and progression of the pharmaceutical and pornographic industries in the West, and as a theoretical consideration of how these produced and maintained the construction of gender in the 20th century.
Oof.
So quite a combination.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a heady mix of sex theory and history, and this is what makes the book's analysis of gender so comprehensive and compelling. And basically, Preciado is arguing that we are in the pharmacopornographic era right now.
Yeah, which I love that you introduced as basically, because that sounds so dense and theoretical, which isn't what we normally do with the podcast.
No, but a challenge mm-hmm. for us. I think it's worth saying that despite the fact that this is a very theory-heavy book, we aren't interested, right now at least, in discussing the theoretical content in its detail and trying to understand it. So what exactly the book is arguing is not going to be the focus of this episode, as much
right.
as how the argument is presented and the various ways in which it shifts formally and tonally throughout the book. I mean, obviously we do have to understand what it's about.
Exactly. I think, yeah, in order to talk about what the book's doing and what it is offering as a polemic or manifesto or piece of performative fiction or romance novel, it is maybe necessary to at least attempt a kind of summary of the theoretical parts and to get to grips a bit with what this pharmacopornographic era is that we're currently living in. Also because it's fascinating, not just as a means to talk about the more juicy parts. So I think it's correct to say that the book offers a particular historical narrative, tracing a line between different forms of state governance, pharmaceutical developments, and sexual norms in the West from around the late 1930s onwards. But its historical breadth is huge. Like, it goes all the way back to medieval witchcraft and looking at how we got to this point, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So Preciado does this over many chapters, and what we're going to do here is offer a very broad overview of the kind of historical and theoretical moves and claims made.
Yeah, so let's go back to the title and start from there.
Mm.
Testo Junkie, Sex, Drugs and Biopolitics in the Pharmacopornographic Era. So I think we'll take the two main concepts in the title, because we know what sex and drugs are, so I think we can skip those.
Mm. Or we think we do.
Do we? Who knows? So, Matty, why don't we start with biopolitics?
Yeah, so as you might have guessed, one of Preciado's main interlocutors is Michel Foucault. So Foucault is the French philosopher who is perhaps most famous for theorising the role of power in the ways in which societies are formed and governed, and really for conceptualising this idea of biopower, which Rosie is now going to explain for us.
Yes. So to give a very quick overview of this, Foucault first used this term in the mid-1970s in a lecture, and then the term appeared in his book called The History of Sexuality, where he uses it to describe the role the state has in exercising control over and disciplining populations through seemingly innocent methods. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean?
Well, Foucault says that these techniques emerged in the second half of the 18th century when states in the West started to record and measure the birth and mortality rates of the population. This then resulted in the development of organisations that coordinated medical care and centralised power, so medicalising the population and creating a public knowledge of hygiene,
okay,
etc. So things like recording population numbers and centralising medical care, which we all take for granted now, I suppose, are methods the state uses to control the life of its citizens. So if we take sexuality as an example, it's from Foucault that we learn that homosexuality was created as a deviant category, first used in 1868, to distinguish between heterosexuality as the norm and any other form of sexual expression, so creating distinctions that were used to repress and control those who did not comply with this heterosexual norm.
Great. Not great.
Well, terrible, clear, in fact. So, according to Foucault, these disciplining methods, for example, categorising people's sexualities in order to track reproduction and control the spread of disease, are ways of disciplining individual bodies in order to control entire populations.
Mm-hmm.
If the population rate and the health of the people are monitored, then they will serve the state well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. In his later works, Foucault also made the connection between biopolitics and state racism, which will also come up a bit later.
Yeah, and many people have critiqued the lack of attention he pays to colonialism in his discussion of the development of Western power structures, like, throughout.
So this is the broad genealogy that Preciado's book is working from, this idea that biopolitics is key to understanding how power works in the 20th and 21st centuries. And Preciado moves from where Foucault left off towards looking at forms of control and power during what he calls the pharmacopornographic era, which we are currently living in.
Mm-hmm.
He says that Foucault's analysis seems to fall off the closer it gets to the contemporary.
It's
and that's
such
where,
shade.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where he is stepping in.
Yeah.
Post-World War II, with the analysis of the technologies of the body, surgery, endocrinology, and genetic engineering, and kind of the changing of representations of the body, like TV, internet, photography,
yeah,
film.
Great. Well done, Rosie.
Whew.
So, yeah, and so this analysis of contemporary forms of biopower is all just gathered under this big concept, the pharmacopornographic mm-hmm. era, which is, like, really at the centre of the book, and it's not as dry and theoretical as it sounds.
No.
Okay, well, I mean, it is theoretical, but it's also so much more. I mean, it's really the driving force of the book, and I think it brings together all the formal and generic elements of the book into this argument. So not just theory, but also, mm-hmm. like, thought experiment and fiction.
Yeah. And we really tried for a long time to figure out how we could present this argument, and there's so much rich and fascinating information in the book, but we kept getting kind of stuck, I think, because we were trying to separate Preciado's presentation of the historical and theoretical information from what we were calling the more personal chapters, as if these are separate modes of research. But as Preciado says, he's taking testosterone so he can write this book.
Mm.
These words are a direct effect of this transformative bodily experience. So to separate the personal from the historical and theoretical seemed to disavow his project in some way. So our approach is going to be to consider all of this information as showing us what the pharmacopornographic era is, not just its historical origins, but how it's experienced and how it can be resisted. And also to consider what kind of writing and knowledge making is most conducive to this project.
Yeah.
So, Matty, you can start.
Well, okay. Right. So while we're not considering these chapters or these forms of knowledge production as wholly separate, it is also the case that certain things are more concentrated in different chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So in chapters such as the pharmacopornographic era, Preciado quite extensively maps out his understanding of history, and specifically the ways in which bodies are governed and subjectivities formed today through techniques and technologies of what he calls pharmaco and porno power. So maybe we can give a couple of concrete examples of that we think are key for Preciado, or that somehow are a representative of the book's approach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's loads of these, but I think there are a few that are particularly important, or maybe these are just the ones that also jumped out to us
yeah.
as being, like, they translated really well or seemed really compelling. So one of the most helpful and exciting, actually, examples for me in the pharmacopower section is the description of what happens to the understanding of gender in 1950s America. So just as Foucault theorises the construction of categories of sexual difference and sexuality is emerging in the 19th century, Preciado in this book is showing us how gender came to be a thing in the 20th century, and specifically how gender is technologically and pharmaceutically produced today. So my understanding of this is that in the 19th century, bodies were governed according to their reproductive capacity. So this idea of sexual difference, the belief that people are either men or women, as an epistemology, is completely tied in with compulsory heterosexual reproduction. So here Preciado, in his kind of elucidation of this history, draws from trans theorists Suzanne Kessler and Wendy McKenna, who say that during the 19th century, people began to be, quote, diagnosed at birth as potential sperm and egg carriers.
Ugh, which, so sinister.
Yeah, it's a really helpful metaphor, like, it's so medical, and I think in this way draws attention to this idea that, like, what happens at birth to babies is a medical intervention.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of denaturalizes the idea of sexual difference in the sense of seeing how it becomes something that is a label that is imposed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I suppose, just as a bit of a tangent, for like trans theorists to say this is really politically important, in the sense that trans identity for so long has been diagnosed as a form of psychosis. And so to kind of flip the switch and suggest that actually gender or sexual difference as a form of like integral to someone's being and their entire lives is a form of diagnosis as well that happens at birth. But then what happens in the 1950s, and Preciado is looking at the US in particular, is that these so-called sperm and egg carriers begin to resist that simple imperative on a political level. So we get things like the rise of feminism, the gradual visibility of homosexuality, and also the demand from those then classed as transsexuals to undergo sex reassignment surgery. And also during this time, researchers such as John Money are beginning to realise that, you know, other than the capacity to impregnate, gestate and lactate, there really is no definitive difference between those classed as men and women, and that hormones such as testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone are found in all bodies to varying degrees. And so a more complex understanding of what Money actually calls gender identity in the 1950s is required. And Preciado takes this moment that I really like in the book to point out that when faced with these threats to the binary order of sexual difference, and with this new research, this new understanding of sexual dimorphism, the medical and political powers that be could have begun to produce alternative, more varied understandings of embodiment, but instead actually came down harder than ever on the side of sexual difference. And this is really where the pharmacopornographic forms of biopower come into play, those that involve actively producing gender through, and to cite Preciado's examples, surgical, prosthetic and hormonal techniques. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Matty.
Clear?
Very, very concise.
Okay.
And so our next example is perhaps the most infamous and influential pharmaceutical development of the 20th century.
Da, da, da.
Birth control. Like it's a character.
Yeah, here and comes birth control.
And with the creation of the pill, which is the kind of birth control Preciado is talking about, we get the technical separation of heterosexuality and reproduction. And the pill is a great example of how the biopolitical strategies of the pharmacopornographic era are ones that appear to be both liberating and repressive.
Mm.
So the pill seems to be a particularly useful example because through this analysis, Preciado is able to explore the anxieties surrounding the separation between femininity and reproduction and the dominance of the norms of heterosexual and nuclear families in the US. For example, the pill was developed to mimic a regular menstrual cycle when actually it could just stop it altogether without any adverse side effects, just so there was no threat to the perceived natural connection between menstruation and femininity.
Yeah, and this is something that we can still think about because, like, I can even remember going on the pill myself and my mum being so like wanting me to have one that still involved having a period, but it's not a real period, it's completely synthetic.
Yeah,
but it's supposed to make you feel that you're still, your body's still behaving in a supposedly natural way, when actually it's a way that mimics like reproductive capacities, as if those are like part of your, as if those are natural, and actually it's just an idea of femininity, really.
Yeah, and the whole point of taking the pill is so you can't reproduce.
Exactly.
Often. So that seems such a strange contradiction.
I think This is definitely one of the strongest parts of the book, and I think especially because it draws out the ways in which race and racialization play into the production of gender in the West. So first of all, it seems important to note that Preciado tells us that the early research into hormonal control that led to the contraceptive pill was first thought of simultaneously as a eugenic device for controlling non-white population growth in the US, and also as a means of assisting sterile white Catholic families to reproduce, because at the beginning when they were kind of working with what hormones could do, the aim wasn't always or not only to limit reproduction but also perhaps to assist it.
Okay. And with regard to the large-scale testing of the pill by the inventors, John Rock and Gregory Pincus, their move to testing the pill hormones on humans led them to try and find the most controllable portion of the ovulating female population, or, quote, a cage of ovulating females.
Ugh.
So creepy. And therefore, they implemented the testing of the pill on women living on the island of Puerto Rico, because these women were considered to be docile, poor, and uneducated, and the inventors thought that if they were able to manage this so-called complex regime, then white American women would surely be able to, one of the many abhorrent ideas that they peddled. And so began the first drug trial to be enacted in the domestic space of the home. These women were subjected to rigorous and invasive routines to ensure the efficacy of the hormones, and therefore extending the methods of control from bodies to the homes that they lived in.
Yeah, and also Preciado talks about how the actual buildings that these women were living in were state-owned and were part of like a kind of cleaning up process.
It basically is saying that the forms of control that are architectural and bodily become interconnected.
Exactly.
Then. And this was nothing new. In fact, these actions just continued a long history of sterilisation and population control of specifically non-white women on the island enacted by the American state. And Preciado writes that the island was treated as, quote, an extended non-white female body, unquote, that the pill regulated. And I think it's useful here to imagine the space as a body as well as the body as a body, and this extension of racial manipulation and regulation that was enacted through and determined by this supposedly liberatory effects of birth control.
Right, and I wonder if at that point it was actually expected to be liberatory for these women, or whether it was like later on that that narrative of it being liberatory gets taken up.
And yeah, Preciado speaks of the history of treatment of women in Puerto Rico and how the traditional North American and European separation of space architecturally was according to gender and sexuality. So an example of this is housewives cooking in the home and sex workers in brothels, and how this was implemented as part of the colonial logic in Puerto Rico. And this meant that poor non-white women were not understood as bodies that should reproduce, but to function as sex workers.
Right.
So it's not, it's so they can't reproduce, but in order for them to be...
to serve another purpose.
Yeah. And these roles served, yeah, a double purpose for the state, managing population control and the so-called deviancy of these women.
Right. And I think it's worth saying here that, of course, Preciado is really interested in the way that the pill is first tested in this colonial setting and then comes to be marketed towards a white middle-class population. But this is just one way of looking into the relationship between birth control and femininity and race. Because later in the book, he very briefly mentions Norplant, which was a kind of early version of the implant you can get these days that sits under the skin of your upper arm and releases hormones. And the legal scholar Dorothy Roberts has written extensively about the way that Norplant was embraced by the right wing in the 90s and how several US states tried to introduce legislation which would actually allow for the state to threaten to cut women's welfare if they wouldn't have Norplant implanted. So she looks at how the discourse around this is particularly racialized, like how it was discussed in the press, and she reveals this desire for racist forms of population control. And her analysis and like historical and legal research is so extensive. And I don't know, I just wish that Preciado had referenced it, because his reference to Norplant is like so kind of brief. It's literally like two sentences, and I would have just loved a little bit more. But really, this is just to say that there are so many different ways of understanding the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and forms of control in the 20th century. And it's just good to remember that Preciado's historical narrative is just one of many, which is obviously not something that I think he would deny. But this movement of pharmaceutical testing that you're talking about from the laboratory into the domestic space or a kind of domesticated laboratory in a way.
That's a useful term, actually.
Well, this is really important for his analysis because the pill in the book emerges as this like perfect example of the shift of forms of control from those of the 19th century to those of the pharmacopornographic era. So I'm going to go into a little bit of history here.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
So Preziado introduces us to Foucault's analysis of the panopticon as a model for understanding how biopower worked in the 19th century as a form of control in which everybody, like everybody and everybody, is visible and subject to state management and classification. So the panopticon is a building. It's an architectural structure made up of individual cells built in concentric circles in which each cell is visible from a central observation tower whose occupant is unseen by those in the cells. And the idea being that the observation tower could have somebody in it watching everybody, but the people in the cells would never know if there was someone there or not.
Kind of like a Big Brother situation.
Exactly. I think the theory behind it also being that like the space could be taken up by God. So just this idea that you're always being watched. So it was actually originally imagined by philosopher Jeremy Bentham as a model for increasing factory productivity. And in the 19th and 20th centuries, the design was used in countries such as the US, Ireland, and Spain for building state prisons. But Preziado does this amazing bit of comparative research that leads him to call the pill, and this is where we get back to this idea of birth control, the edible panopticon. So he takes us through the history of how the pill was marketed to housewives in the 1950s, and tells us how pharmaceutical companies were trying to figure out how to make sure that women, who were perceived to be too ignorant to be able to follow simple instructions, needed a simple form of packaging to make the whole taking a pill every day thing a bit easier. And what they came up with was a circular pill box designed to look like a telephone, because, you know, women love to use the phone.
I do. No. But I do think, actually, that if we go back, that one of the first iterations of the pill was quite complex because you had to monitor your menstrual cycle and then take specific pills on specific days.
Right.
And then after that, they developed a pack where you take one a day and the important ones are intercut with placebos.
Okay. It's still kind of offensive.
Yeah.
And I think it's the, like, the visuals of the marketing that he's especially interested in, which is this, like, hyper-feminine image. Also, this idea, I think, in some of the adverts of like your husband being involved in the whole process, so it's this like way of regulating together. And
yay.
I think a part of it is one of the adverts was to like you take it at bedtime, which is always at 11 o'clock or something,
because everyone listens to the 11 o'clock news.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's like the music for the 11 o'clock news should remind you to take your pill, because that's what everybody in America does at 11 o'clock.
So what you see is this really uniform idea of who this woman is who's taking the pill emerging through this marketing campaign. But Preziado is looking at the visuals of this circular telephone-looking pill box. So Preziado said at a talk that I went to last year that one of his ways of doing research is to literally put loads of images of objects of interest on a table, and the panopticon and the picture of the original circular pill box jumped out at him as being really strikingly similar. And these pictures are in the book, so you can kind of see for yourself. And there's actually a particular quote that I think really lays bare the mechanisms of the pharmacopornographic era that are really evident in this manufacturing of the pill. So Preziado writes, I think you've got the quote.
The surveillance tower of the panopticon is replaced by the docile user of the pill who regulates herself, which is a kind of terrifying idea. But a very clear example of one of the strongest statements of the book, which really clicked a lot of things into place for me, which is the body no longer inhabits disciplinary spaces, but is inhabited by them. So it's no longer that we are surrounded by these disciplinary spaces, but they are within us, whether we decide they are or not.
Yeah. And it's probably, I would have thought, like, from the book, it's also a bit of both that still continues to happen.
Yeah.
Like, lots of people do still inhabit disciplinary spaces, actually.
Of course, but the technologies have advanced to the extent that
they're also occupying us.
Yeah.
Well, he is also looking at, like, how forms of discipline are synthetic and ingested and consumed.
Yeah, so this quote is extremely important and kind of sums up, at least for me, the methodology of the pharmacopornographic era, if an era can be said to have a methodology.
Well, I think that the pill, as an example, so important because it shows us that the pill was never meant to be liberatory, actually. It was deemed as such at a certain point, but only by like a privileged few. Because actually the way it was imagined was as a racist, a sexist, and also, of course, completely heteronormative form of population mm-hmm. control. So,
I mean, it's not to deny that it obviously is liberatory for millions of women, but that right. it came with these... This was the process through which it was designed.
Right. And also that probably echoes still today. Yeah, like, it would definitely. Be interesting to think more about that. So it's also an important example precisely because of that, because it reveals how implicated all bodies are within these systems and how impossible it is to completely escape them.
Mm-hmm.
If you do need a form of birth control for whatever reason, if you need to take hormones, if you have contact with any kind of pharmaceutical product at any point. But we'll come to how Preciado thinks you can resist precisely through your consumption of pharmaceuticals later.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to the next mega topic of the book, if you're ready, which is porno power that we are yet to understand or comprehend, but have decided to talk about anyway. So, according to Preciado, porno power is central to the pharmacopornographic era, obviously making up half of that term. But what is porno power?
My very limited understanding of this, say, line of argument is that everything is driven by sexual potential or desire, and I don't really understand the difference between these things, but he seems to be saying that sexual desire or potential drives even forms of exchange that are not obviously sexual.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes that, and I don't really know how to explain this one, but orgasmic force is the sum of the potential for excitation inherent in every material molecule. It gets a little bit clearer for me what's happening when he says that in order to understand capitalism in the pharmacopornographic era, we need to understand this idea of potential that he calls potentia guidendi. And I mean, it's a modest claim to suggest that in order to understand the world order you've conceptualized, we need another concept to understand how capitalism functions within it. But I expect this chapter is more helpful for those who are more familiar with like Marxist feminism than I am, because he says that labour has been pornified, not feminized. And here critiquing theorists such as Maurizio Lazzarato and Tony Negri, who claim that contemporary work is feminized and immaterial. But at its most basic, this kind of portion of analysis seems to be looking at the ways in which pleasure is capitalized. So,
mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think maybe it's worth going right back to the beginning of the chapter,
okay.
Which starts inexplicably with a list.
Uh-huh.
I assume that it is a list of the things that comprise porno power, or it's like points that accumulate to some kind of conceptualizing of this idea.
Yeah, I kind of liked that the form of this chapter is quite different to some of the others and also not explained.
Yeah, which Preciado does throughout, will just like change form suddenly without explaining. But I mean, it's up to you to work that out. But so, in the first paragraph of this chapter, Preciado quotes Linda Williams's definition of pornography as, quote, an embodied image, going on to explain that this is an image that incorporates itself as body, and captures the body at, quote, the encounter with an eroticized technological apparatus. So to me, this seems to call back the idea of the body being inhabited by disciplinary spaces, and pornographic images being in us at the moment we encounter them, or at the intersection of our body and technology. Okay. And also maybe the potential that all of our bodies have all of the time of becoming pornography. Or maybe he's even saying that they already are.
Okay.
But the process, as I understand it, that he outlines in the first part of this chapter, is that our sexuality is transformed into public representation. And this publicness refers to bodies being marketable and therefore able to take part in an exchange on the global market in a digital form.
Right.
Then, therefore, transforming into capital.
Okay.
So, instead of talking about a specific image or body here, he talks about representation. And it's when this representation becomes public rather than private that it becomes pornographic.
So what we're dealing with here seems to be mainly digital or visual representations that through their publicness become pornographic.
Yeah.
But I think that is an oversimplified reading. But from what I can gather, that's quite a useful start.
Yeah, I think there even is a total disillusion of any public-private separation.
Yes.
Happening in this era. So, well, there are loads of examples that he gives of cultural phenomena that that are used to explore these ideas. So he talks about actually the mainstreaming of porn by Playboy, specifically the first naked picture of Marilyn Monroe as, as the beginning of all this, as a moment in which pornographic content gets put into very wide circulation. But there are so many different kinds of examples where porn apparel is located in relation to pharmaceuticals, actually. And there is a list that Preciado provides that's quite helpful here for giving a sense of the scope of his argument and the breadth of the links made. So he writes that, just to mention a few things, quote, "The rise and fall of Linda Lovelace from Deep Throat, the trafficking of illegal sex workers across European borders, Armstrong's doping, the litres of sperm poured out each year during the making of porn films, the syringe that produced the sheep dolly by insemination, the synthetic guilelessness of weightlifters' muscles. These teach us more about current models of capitalist production than do all the industrial directories of the International Monetary Fund." I struggled a bit with this section because I wanted him to go into more detail. I mean, this is obviously a list and there are more developed arguments throughout, but I just wanted to know a little bit more about the points being made here. And I would agree that this is probably true. Like, these things probably do tell us more about capitalism than the International Monetary Fund. But my question is, like, which comparable and cultural theorists are looking to the International Monetary Fund to learn about capitalism?
And it's one of his very performative and dramatic oversimplified points.
Yeah.
That is on purpose.
Yeah.
But I think that what we can glean from this list or example is that the body and all of its secretions are the initial location of porno power. And here, Preciado also provides an example of resistance to the pornographic construction of performative and heteronormative sexuality. Although, just to be clear, I think Preciado's stance is not that pornography is inherently bad or inherently good, it just is.
Yeah. Or, like, there are forms of pornography that are more violent and exploitative than others. Like, it's not sex and pornography in itself that has difficult or dangerous consequences, but the way it's manipulated and circulated and produced.
Exactly. So he cites Annie Sprinkle, a feminist sex educator, former sex worker and writer, amongst many other things, and her 1990 performance, The Public Cervix Announcement, and her use of the term post-pornography as a way to understand sexuality as performance. And this is presented in parallel with Judith Butler's infamous analysis of gender as a performative reiteration of the norms of masculinity and femininity. Although, for me, this is quite a frustrating section because it's a very underdeveloped argument. It's only about a page long, which seems strange for such a great claim, but I suppose not particularly out of character.
Yeah.
For this, like, performance of knowledge, somehow. But, so in this performance, Annie Sprinkle allowed the audience members to come up to the stage and look at her cervix through a speculum. And this, according to Preciado, was a critique of the visibility allowed by traditional pornography in medicine. So she displaces the perceived passive sexual object and lets, his example here is women, dykes, porn actresses, etc., become subjects of representation. So Sprinkle undermines the status quo of traditional sex and gender roles by allowing the previously repressed object to the fore as an autonomous subject. And while Annie Sprinkle is amazing and revolutionary, it just seems strange to have no acknowledgement of lineage here, as if this was the first moment.
I mean, there's been so much feminist performance art before her doing similar, like, artists doing similar things.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand the difference because Annie Sprinkle is a porn star.
Right.
And a sex worker. It's frustrating in its lack of context because I think it could have been a very interesting argument if extrapolated upon, and it just isn't.
Right. And I think maybe I can just jump in and reiterate that this book is working with a very particular understanding of what sex is and what gender is and what art is and what performance is and a very especially like US-based lineage of thinkers. And it's this trajectory that allows Preciado to make this claim that you know, runs parallel to Judith Butler's theorising of gender performativity, as if this is especially radical. But it's just good to remember that, like, there are other ways of... There are other histories, there are other narratives, there are other epistemologies and contexts for thinking about ways of resisting not just pornography, but, like, the over-sexualisation of certain bodies. So I think this section is just much more densely theoretical and requires a lot of previous knowledge that I just don't have. So it's dense, but it also jumps from topic to topic, from theorist to theorist, without going into that much detail, in a way that's kind of like glorious and exciting, but difficult if you don't, if you can't make the leaps with him, I suppose. I mean, it's definitely Preciado the philosopher, it's most dramatic, and in a way that I just find a bit less effective than in some of the other moments.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think that there's definitely a huge difference in the methodology of this porno power chapter compared with the pharmacopower chapter.
Yeah, which has such, like, long, detailed historical research in it that makes what Preciado is saying quite clear, I think.
Yeah, there's a slight lack of clarity due to the form and style, but it really helped us to find a review of the book by Julian Jill Peterson in the Women and Performance Journal, because the review calls this part of the narrative, or actually maybe just the whole book, unsettlingly precocious.
Yeah.
Which was just a relief, because I think we just both thought, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. But I like the way that the review isn't presenting this as, like, a bad thing,
no,
but almost, like, as a kind of method for dealing with, like, history and knowledge and theory, which I kind of enjoyed. But sometimes the book is, like, being faced with this ridiculously smart kind of high friend who's like, intellectual steps you just cannot quite follow.
But you think that you're experiencing them in a really great way.
Yeah, and you're, like, wowed and overwhelmed by. But that was a lot of information.
Yes, but now it's going to get fun.
Right, so all this info and this, like, theory and history that we've gone into successfully or not so much, up to you, it all accumulates and adds together to make up this overall argument that we're living in the pharmacopornographic era, which is dominated by these different forms of power, the pharmaceutical, the pornographic, which are always connected. But the way that this info is presented is so specific. And I think that to really get a sense of how we experience this as readers, we have to get back to this initial idea of the experiment and the way that Preciado actively engages with the question of how to produce knowledge, how to write in this era. So, lest we forget, Preciado tells us in the introduction of the book that this is an account of what he calls a political experiment that lasted 236 days and nights, in which BP self-administered testosterone in gel form. So this isn't simply a theory book written by Paul Preciado, but it's also, and arguably primarily, a narrative of self-experimentation performed by the assigned female at birth character BP, who takes testosterone for, well, almost a year and documents its effects. I mean, so at one point BP tells us, just to be clear, that he's decided to keep his legal identity as a woman and not to subscribe to a sex change protocol, and actually calls this position one of political arrogance, recognising that it is his privileged position as white, as someone who doesn't need to look for a job, that enables this particular route of taking testosterone that is not available to all of those who want it and need it, or desirable. So it's not simply Preciado writing theory or Preciado writing autobiography, but just, you know, something more exciting. And I mean, we can make this really clear. The first sentence of the introduction is, quote, "This book is not a memoir. This book is a testosterone-based voluntary intoxication protocol which concerns the body and affects of BP. A body essay. Fiction, actually. If things must be pushed to the extreme, this is a somatopolitical fiction. A theory of the self, or self-theory."
Yeah, what does he mean by the self if it is fiction? I mean, we could talk about how the self being fiction or somatopolitical fiction is exactly what the book is suggesting we all are. Somatopolitical fictions living in and shaped by the pharmacopornographic era.
Yeah.
But to go back a minute, maybe the suggestion implicit here is that the self is something that is constructed like a narrative and not some kind of essence of ourselves that we possess no matter what.
Yes. No, definitely. I think he's exploring this, the way that subjectivity is constructed and formed from like a huge mixture of influences and mechanisms. So, you know, sometimes in the book it can seem like BP is using like very theoretical terms to talk about his every experience. But I think that's part of the kind of argument of the book, that this is because he's exploring the ways in which these experiences are constructed and that, you know, that subjectivity is political.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to call it fiction is kind of performative. Not to say that it's not real. I mean, who thinks that of fiction anyway? But to remind us or to show us that the book is also not to be read as a pairing of, say, like hard fact and memoir. I mean, I think it's clear from now that Preziado would refute these categories, but that's what the performative use of the word fiction here does for me. But also it's kind of like a tease, like you don't know me and you don't need to know me in order for the stakes of the book to be real.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to reroute the conversation a bit towards the non-theoretical chapters and start with the quote at the beginning, well, the epigraph at the beginning of the book, which is framed as a question to Jacques Derrida, of course. And it is, if you could see a documentary on a philosopher, on Heidegger, Kant or Hegel, what would you like to see in it? And Derrida's answer is, for them to talk about their sex life.
I don't think I want to watch any of those documentaries.
No, you don't have to, Matty. But this starts the whole book, and do you think it frames the narrator's attitude in some way? I mean, Preziado is basically proposing that this is what he is gifting the reader, an intimate look into BP's sex life, which I, for one, I'm grateful for.
Yeah, me too.
But I've been thinking about it in relation to this kind of audacious quote from the end of the first chapter where Preziado states, quote, I have no other alternative but to accept the fact that the change happening in me is the metamorphosis of an era. Which sounds grandiose and hilariously kind of self-absorbed, but actually...
Well, it's interesting because I wonder if he would think that if Kant or Hegel or Heidegger were to talk about their sex lives, that would also be a way of understanding the metamorphosis of their eras. It seems like what he's suggesting is that it's integral for the philosopher of this era to do that work specifically.
Because that is the only way we can understand our era, through our bodies.
Yeah, and so I think it's not so much this, like, everything, the things that are happening to me are representative of the whole era.
Yeah.
But more that anything that happens to my body can be understood within the context of my time, which is actually much less self-centered than like the original, the quote could seem to suggest.
Yeah.
I mean, this centralizing of the self and knowledge production is just a huge part of his approach to theory making, to what it means to create knowledge in the pharmacopornographic era. And this is where we really get the concept of auto-theory, which is properly addressed with the suggestion, actually, that to continue Foucault's work, which is the task that Preziado does seem to have set himself, within this era, does mean turning the analysis inwards, both in terms of, like, inwards to the physical body and also inwards to the, like, construction of subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, this is actually a direct repetition of that earlier quote I read about how looking to the, like, discourse around Linda Lovelace, for example, tells us more about capitalism than the International Monetary Fund. But later in the book, he tells us that this same group of contemporary phenomena tells us more about philosophy than any philosophy book of the 20th century. And so here comes the auto-theory quote. The philosophy of the pharmacopornographic regime has been reduced to an enormous dripping butt-plug camera. In such circumstances, the philosophy of such high-punk modernity can only be auto-theory, auto-experimentation, auto-techno-penetration, pornology. So there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Now, this for me is exemplary of the attitude that drives the book. The centralising of the transformation of Preziado's body through taking testosterone as something that condenses all the theoretical arguments into a bodily shift, as like a way of grounding social and political change into specific personal experience. And Preziado even says later that he puts the 50 milligrams of Testogel on his skin so he can write this book, which I think I mentioned earlier.
Mm.
And these ideas that have been committed to the page are a direct result of altering the levels of testosterone in the body. And that in itself is wild, yeah, to follow this logic of a hormone in liquid form, producing or providing the condition for these ideas to come to fruition. And it seems, in a way, to be the perfect example of the pharmacopornographic era. So maybe I would argue that this claim, along with the double penetration scene that I'll talk about next, is Preciado showing us what the pharmacopornographic era consists of and how it operates, or how it can operate in bodies.
And how to operate within it in a way that reveals its mechanisms and maybe challenges
exactly
them.
Exactly, Matty. So this double penetration scene comes in the first chapter, right at the beginning of the book, before we've had any of the theory stuff.
Yeah.
And it is a description of a video that BP makes the day that his friend GD dies. And this briefly involves BP shaving his head and then using the hair to glue on a small moustache, shaving his pubic hair, and then putting on a strap-on and double penetrating himself.
Huh?
Matty looks confused. Not with the strap-on. That would be
different. Not with the strap-on that he's wearing. Okay.
No. And it's incredible writing. It's kind of both somber and sexy and kind of removed, as if Preciado is describing somebody else doing it. And yeah, what do you think, Matty?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's this kind of mournful, eulogistic element to it, at the same time as it being like kind of shocking. I mean, when my voice went so high there, I'm such a prude. No, but I just think you have no idea what you're getting when you read this. Like, you don't know what kind of a book you're going to be reading. And I think it's easy to forget this scene, actually, as you go through the book.
Yeah.
But this is how the book starts, in this kind of, with a performance in front of a camera that is so highly personal, also erotic, also all about death and mourning. So,
and seems to me to be exemplifying so many components of the pharmacopornographic era, but before we've reached those in the text. So somehow it also manages to be incredibly subtle.
Yeah.
In like a very strange way.
Yeah, because at so many points in the book, Preciado is telling you exactly what he's doing and is clearly stating this means this. And there are so many kind of concise sentences that wrap up the arguments in ways that can be really helpful. But I also like that we do get this moment, and I'm sure there are others as well, that are not explained, that we're left to kind of think about ourselves.
Exactly, but also somehow contains all these topics that become topics later on, but at this point are just observations, or are just facts of the scene.
Mm.
So the suggestion of assigned gender norms, the heterosexual matrix, drugs, medically prescribed hormones, the internet video, pharmacopornographic subjectivities that these all produce, are kind of inherent in this scene, but we just are not kind of aware of them in that sense yet. But also, I kind of think that the whole book is held in this chapter somehow, and it's titled Your Death. It's just such an intense component of the book that is reiterated at the very end, I think, but disappears slightly.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute. But I think it is really interesting because the book does weave among so many different kinds of writing. I mean, there really is a difference between chapters like Jimmy and Me, which is all about a dildo, and this writing, like this scene at the beginning of the book, and then a chapter like The Micropolitics of Gender in the Pharmacopornographic Era. But at the same time, there's also a blurring of genre and forms of knowledge production going on. One of the most helpful ways for me to think about what the book is doing in terms of genre, actually, is to think about it as a polemic and even a manifesto. Because I think one of the most striking things about this book, and about Preciado as a thinker in general, is how he can be so clear and concise.
Mm-hmm.
And how there's a kind of activism to his writing. Because I think he is actually calling for some very concrete, practical things here.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the democratization of hormones, which is really important. So he writes that freely circulating and collectively used testosterone is dynamite for the heterosexual regime, and which I really like, which is a model of circulation that is different to the way that hormones are managed and distributed in most countries today. Like, for example, if you're trans, in most countries you have to declare yourself as suffering gender dysphoria in order to gain access to the hormones you need. Mm-hmm. So to partake in a particularly medicalized narrative of your relationship to gender, that is just not true of many people's experiences of their gender, their bodies, themselves. So that's one practical thing. The other is, like, he suggests kind of modes of queer resistance. One of them is undertaking drag king workshops as a form of what he calls queer analysis, which is presented as like an alternative to psychoanalysis. And this is a really like fun part of the book where he writes about participating in these workshops and then running them himself.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine.
CKUT Radio, Community Radio, CKUT.ca, CKUT. 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's gonna be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.